Imagine for a second. You're sitting in the pitch black. You're injured. You are, entirely alone.
Right.
You're tucked away in this rocky mountain crevice, miles inside hostile territory. And, with absolute certainty that an entire nation's military apparatus is actively hunting for you.
Yeah, that is, I mean, it's terrifying to even think about.
It really is. Every single second that ticks by is a second where the odds of survival just mathematically drop. And that intense high-stakes isolation is, well, it's the reality we're unpacking today. Welcome to this deep dive.
Thanks. Yeah, it is basically the starkest scenario you can face in modern aviation. I mean, you survive the violent kinetic ejection from a dying aircraft, you survive the parachute drop.
Right, which is a miracle in itself.
Exactly. But the moment your boots actually hit the dirt, the hardest phase of the battle actually begins.
And the mission of today's deep dive is to, cut right through those initial fog of war headlines. We want to look at the actual anatomy of a modern combat search and rescue mission.
Because it's wild.
It is. And we're pulling from a really fascinating stack of recent reporting today. Specifically, we've got the field notes from the military report by Isaac Cubillos, dated early April 2026. Because, the story here isn't just about some helicopter swooping in and picking up a stranded guy.
Oh, no, not at all.
It's this intricate look at the staggering lengths, the geopolitical deception, and the massive calculated sacrifices that are required to bring just one single American airman home.
Yeah, and the public almost never gets to see that raw machinery, the stuff that operates in the gap between the initial aircraft down report and the final crew recovered press release.
Right, the stuff that happens in the dark.
Exactly. The official briefings are just deliberately sterilized, but the operational reality is it's deeply messy. It's fraught with friction, and it involves this massive orchestra of moving parts that all have to perform perfectly under the worst possible conditions.
Okay, so let's lay out the facts of the initial chaos. So an American F-15E Strike Eagle goes down over Iran.
Wow.
Two crew members eject. The early reports just come flooding in, and they are incredibly contradictory, as you'd expect. The initial rumor mill says both were rescued immediately, but then as the actual data filters through, the story kind of shifts.
Yeah, the fog of war starts to lift a bit.
Right. One crew member is quietly grabbed early on, and that's a detail that was eventually confirmed by Israeli media, CBS, and Axios. However, the other crew member, the weapon system officer, or WSO, is missing.
And look, the second a U.S. service member is unaccounted for on hostile soil, this aggressive information war just instantly kicks off.
Because it's not just a military problem at that point, right?
Exactly. An American aviator on the ground in Iran isn't just a tactical problem, it is a massive geopolitical event. So, Iranian state television rushes to dominate the narrative. They broadcast that they didn't just shoot down like a legacy F-15, they claim they bagged a fifth-generation stealth F-35.
Wow, just a straight-up fabrication.
Oh, yeah. And they tell the world the pilot is dead. It is textbook propaganda. It's designed to project overwhelming military superiority to their own people and the world.
But the propaganda simply doesn't hold up to scrutiny, right? Because aviation experts take one look at the wreckage being broadcast on Iranian TV and they immediately identify the airframe.
Right. You can't really hide the debris signature.
Yeah, it tells the real story. It's an F-15E, likely from the 484th Fighter Squadron out of RAF Lakenheath. But okay, here is the bizarre part to me. As the whole world is looking at burning American wreckage on their TV screens, U.S. Central Command CIACOM issues an official statement claiming that, quote, all aircraft have been accounted for.
Which, I mean, looks entirely absurd to anyone watching the news.
It's baffling. Why maintain a stone-cold bluff when the cards are already face up on the table? The wreckage is public. I look at this and I just wonder how denying reality helps the military in any way. It's like a poker player furiously kicking their team under the table while trying to maintain this completely unbelievable bluff. It seems like it would just severely damage CIATCOM's credibility.
Well, what's fascinating here is that if you look at this purely from a public relations standpoint, sure, yeah, it seems foolish. But CNTCOM is operating on a tactical timeline, not a PR timeline.
Okay, so what does that mean in practice?
When an aircraft goes down in denied territory, the primary adversary isn't necessarily the hostile army on the ground, it's the clock. By issuing a flat, official denial, the United States forces the adversary's intelligence apparatus to just pause.
Oh, you mean they freeze their decision-making loop?
Precisely. In military theory, it's about disrupting the ODO loop observe, orient, decide, act. If Washington officially says no planes are missing, Iranian commanders have to stop and ask themselves, wait, are we sure? Did we shoot down a drone instead? Is this some sort of trap?
So it introduces doubt.
Exactly. And that confusion might only buy you, like, 2 or 3 hours. But in a combat search and rescue operation, 2 hours is an eternity. Behind the curtain, that is exactly the time required to spin up a covert American rescue machine. But, you know, to utilize that time, you need a diversion.
Okay, let's unpack this. Because the Central Intelligence Agency's opening move here is just a masterclass in psychological misdirection. Before a single rescue helicopter even lifts off the tarmac, the CIA launches a massive deception campaign inside Iran.
Right. They go to work immediately.
Yeah. They start feeding fake rumors into the Iranian intelligence ecosystem, spreading the narrative that U.S. forces have already found the missing weapons system officer, and they're actively moving him overland toward a border.
Mm.
But mechanics-wise, how do you actually fake a rescue operation? You can't just tweet that you found him.
No, no. It requires saturating their intelligence-gathering tools with false positives. So the CIA might spoof encrypted radio bursts from a completely different mountain range to, you know, simulate a special operations team communicating.
Hey, I don't...
Yeah, or they might burn low-level double agents by having them leak fabricated sightings of American troops moving in a convoy.
So it's basically just about creating noise.
Yeah, and it doesn't have to be a flawless, bulletproof lie. It just has to be loud and plausible enough to demand a response. An Iranian regional commander cannot ignore a report that an American team is moving toward his border. He has to deploy troops to investigate it.
Because if he doesn't, and it's true, he looks terrible.
Exactly. So by getting Iranian security forces to rush toward the wrong highways or set up checkpoints in the wrong provinces, the CIA is physically clearing the airspace and the ground around the actual target area.
That's the old magician's trick.
Hmm.
Make them look at the left hand while the right hand does the real work. And while this false trail is running hot, the CIA is executing the real search. According to the sources, the officials say the CIA utilized exquisite capabilities to find the real target. And they do find him. He's alive, he's injured, and he's hiding out in incredibly rough terrain. But I really have to push back on that phrase. Exquisite capabilities is such clinical, boring intelligence jargon. I feel like it completely glosses over the physical reality of locating one single human being in the Zagros Mountains. I mean, it's like finding a needle in a haystack if the haystack was on fire and actively trying to kill you.
Yeah, it is jargon for sure, but it represents the absolute bleeding edge of modern surveillance synthesis. Finding a downed aviator isn't just taking a nice satellite photo. You're looking at hundreds of square miles of cold, jagged rock. So first, you task a satellite to scan for thermal anomalies.
Right, looking for body heat.
Exactly. But a thermal anomaly could be a goat. Or, you know, a local shepherd's fire.
So how do you filter out the noise? How do you know it's him?
You layer the data. You take that thermal imaging and overlay it with signals intelligence. Like, did a cell tower ping a localized encrypted distress frequency? Did the aviator survival radio emit a microburst of telemetry in that specific grid square? You combine the physical heat signature with the invisible electronic footprint. When those distinct data sets intersect on a map, boom, you have your man.
That makes total sense, but it still feels like magic.
Yeah.
But okay, locating him shifts the entire operational burden because beaming those coordinates back to the Pentagon means you are no longer just observing. The intelligence phase is basically over. The kinetic phase begins.
And that transition is the most dangerous pivot in the entire operation.
Why is that?
Because knowing his exact location means the stakes are fundamentally altered. You have a moral and doctrinal obligation to go get him.
Right. The order comes down from C-HANCOM, and they do not just send a lone helicopter sneaking through the dark. They assemble an armada. We're talking HH-60, Pavehawk helicopters, specialized pararescue teams, the PJs and multiple fixed-wing aircraft flying low and fast to avoid radar.
A massive package.
It is. But this brings up a massive technical question for me. The sources, specifically the New York Times reporting we looked at, they note that massive fixed-wing transport planes, likely MC-130 variants, actually landed inside Iranian territory on a forward dirt airstrip.
Yeah.
Why on earth would you bring a four-engine cargo plane on a discreet, quiet rescue mission? Why not just use the helicopters?
Well, it all comes down to the brutal physics of aviation fuel. An HH-60 Pave Hawk carrying heavily armed pararescuemen is incredibly heavy. When you fly heavy, and you fly low to the deck to avoid surface-to-air missiles, you burn fuel at an astronomical rate.
Just guzzling gas.
Exactly. Helicopters simply do not have the range to take off from a friendly base outside Iran, penetrate deep into the Zagros Mountains, loiter in the air while a complex rescue happens, and then fly all the way back out.
So they basically need a gas station.
That's exactly it. They need a forward arming and refueling point, or what the military calls a FARP. They use the MC-130s as flying gas stations. The transport plane lands on a dry lake bed or a remote strip of dirt, keeps its engines running, and the helicopters just land right behind it to take on fuel through these massive hoses before pushing forward to the target.
Okay, conceptually I get it. But the reality of landing an aircraft that size in hostile territory is absolutely terrifying. And here's where it gets really interesting, because this is where the plan hits a massive wall of friction. Two of these MC-130s land on the forward airstrip, and they get stuck.
Yeah, worst case scenario.
The terrain is softer than anticipated. The planes are loaded down with tens of thousands of pounds of fuel. The ambient heat plays a factor, and they just sink into the mud. I mean, it's like trying to parallel park a school bus in a minefield, getting its tires stuck in the mud, and realizing the whole neighborhood is waking up. The ground simply cannot distribute the weight, and the landing gear just buries itself.
Yeah, there is a saying in the military that no plan survives first contact with the enemy.
In this case, the plan didn't even survive first contact with the dirt.
Right, and that is the harsh reality of expeditionary aviation. An MC-130 is not a nimble aircraft. Once the landing gear is mired in soft earth, all four engines at max throttle will not pull it out. You are instantly transformed from a highly mobile rescue force into a static, sitting target deep inside enemy lines.
So what happens in the command center at that exact moment? The panic must be unreal.
The tactical picture just violently morphs. You went from a focused extraction of one single weapon system officer to a full-blown crisis. A commander is suddenly staring down the sunk cost fallacy in real time. Your American forces are literally multiplying on the ground in denied territory.
Right. You've got dozens of guys just sitting there.
Yeah. Highly trained air crews sitting in utterly useless aircraft. So CNTCOM now has to scramble and send three more aircraft into the hot zone. And their mission isn't to find the downed WSO anymore. They're going in to rescue the rescue force.
The mathematical weight of that decision is staggering. I mean, you are risking dozens of lives and hundreds of millions of dollars of equipment to save one person, and suddenly your exposure rate just quintupled.
It's agonizing. The commander has to weigh the life of the WSO against the very real possibility of losing a 40-person rescue package. But in the U.S. military, the doctrine dictates that you push forward. You do not turn back. However, you also cannot leave those trapped MC-130s behind. A brutal choice has to be made regarding the stranded aircraft.
Right. And the order comes down to destroy the planes in place. They have to blow them up right there on the dirt airstrip. But, I mean, it's not as simple as just tossing a grenade into the cargo hold, is it? We are talking about flying servers packed with highly classified technology.
Far from simple. The procedure is highly methodical. First, the crew has to execute a process called zeroizing. They use specialized protocols to wipe the digital brains of the aircraft, erasing all cryptographic keys used for secure communications and wiping any proprietary targeting algorithms. So the software is destroyed first.
Okay, and then the hardware.
Yes, then the hardware. You use thermite grenades and placed explosives. Thermite burns at thousands of degrees. They literally place it directly onto the avionics racks to melt hard drives and classified circuit boards into unrecognizable slag.
Just melting it into a puddle.
Exactly. Yeah. Then they use explosives to destroy the engine blocks and the structural integrity of the airframe itself. It all has to burn. Because if the Iranians capture an intact MC-130, they gain a massive unrecoverable intelligence windfall.
And we actually know this protocol was followed perfectly, because a few days later, Iranian semi-state media broadcast images of the black smoke and the totally burned out husks of the C-130s on the ground. It's a very visceral, ugly image to see American aircraft destroyed like that.
It is an ugly image, but strategically, it is a total success. You sanitize the site so the enemy gains zero intelligence advantage from your misfortune. You just write off the cost of the metal.
But the muddle burning on the airstrip is really only half of the climax here. Because while the MC-130s are being reduced to ash, The HH-60 Pavehawks and the pararescuemen actually reach the crevice where the weapons system officer is hiding.
Yeah, the mission continues.
And I want to spend a minute on this tactical extraction because it is the entire reason this massive apparatus even exists in the first place. The PJs don't just, like, land and wave them onto the helicopter.
Oh, not at all. A combat search and rescue extraction is a highly choreographed tactical maneuver. When the PJs hit the dirt, the first element establishes a 360-degree security perimeter. They assume the enemy is closing in, even if they can't see them on night vision. The second element moves to the isolated personnel.
And the WSO was injured during the ejection, so they have to do medical triage in the dark.
Precisely. PJs aren't just shooters. They are highly advanced combat medics. They have to stabilize his spine, assess for internal bleeding, and administer life-saving care while literally under the threat of enemy fire. They package the patient into a rescue litter, load him onto the PAPOC, and, this is crucial, they verify the physical identity of the airmen to ensure they haven't walked into a trap or an ambush. Only then does the flight lead call for extraction.
Man, so you have helicopters lifting off at the wounded airmen, you have secondary aircraft pulling the stranded MC-130 crews out of the mud, and you have massive cargo planes just burning in the background.
Oh.
It is absolute chaos. But by just after 1 a.m. Eastern time on Easter Sunday, all U.S. personnel are pulled out. They left the burning planes, but they got every single person out alive.
Which is an incredible feat.
So what does this all mean when the dust settles?
Well, if we connect this to the bigger picture, the historical echoes here are just deafening. Any military historian looking at burned transport planes in the Iranian desert is immediately going to think of 1980.
Operation Eagle Claw.
Yes, exactly. Operation Eagle Claw was the mission to rescue the American hostages held in Tehran. And it ended in total disaster at a staging area called Desert One. Helicopters collided with a transport plane in the dark. 8 American service members died. They left burnout aircraft and bodies in the sand. It was a profound national trauma. I mean, it actually forced the complete restructuring of U.S. Special Operations Command.
Wow. And here we are, decades later, looking at burned out transport planes in the Iranian dirt once again. It feels like history repeating itself in the worst possible way.
And the visual is the same, sure, but the outcome is fundamentally different. Eagle Claw failed. This operation, despite the staggering friction and the loss of multi-million dollar airframes, was a success. It perfectly synthesizes the core military doctrine that was literally born out of the ashes of 1980. You can lose messy, expensive, high-tech equipment. You can write off the loss of heavy transport planes. But you never, ever leave the human behind. The people are the irreplaceable asset.
Write off the metal, never leave the human. That is such a powerful doctrine, and the coordination required to actually execute it is awe-inspiring. But looking at Isaac Ubio's reporting, even with the successful rescue and the safe return of the WSO, there's a very dark, lingering cloud hanging over this entire geopolitical event.
There is, and it fundamentally alters the strategic calculus moving forward. Let's look at the catalyst for this entire deep dive. An F-15E Strike Eagle was shot down.
Right.
The Strike Eagle is a heavily armored, incredibly capable workhorse of a jet. If Iran's air defense networks are now capable of reaching out and killing a low-flying Strike Eagle, it means something in the region has shifted.
Yeah, the sources mentioned that the airspace is getting tighter. What does that mean practically?
The skies got tighter. That means the safety margins that American aviators have relied on for decades are shrinking. The adversary's radar systems are getting more sensitive, their surface-to-air missiles are getting faster, and their electronic warfare capabilities are improving. Whether they're learning, adapting, or receiving advanced technology from outside state actors, the reality is that the airspace is becoming hyper-lethal.
Which means the next time an aircraft goes down, the rescue package might not actually make it through those defenses.
Right.
So, as we wrap up this deep dive, I want you, the listener, to consider the sheer weight of what we've unpacked today. This isn't an action movie where the script guarantees a clean getaway. We just looked at the terrifying, friction-filled reality of modern warfare. You have psychological deception from the CIA. You have commanders making brutal mathematical choices about human life and sunk costs. And you have highly trained medics doing triage in the dirt while airplanes burn around them.
Yeah, all of those elements violently colliding for the sake of saving one single life.
Exactly. I want you to sit with that thought for a moment. Imagine knowing that an entire nation's military apparatus, the spy satellites, the bombers, the elite operators, will deliberately risk a catastrophic international incident just to bring you home. They will willingly crash their own planes and melt them into the mud if it means getting you out. It is a massive burden, but it is also an incredible promise to the men and women who fly those jets.
It is a profound promise. But you know, this raises an important question. As we look at the geopolitical landscape, it is a promise that is becoming mathematically and strategically difficult to maintain. And that brings us to a final provocative thought regarding the future of warfare. We established that the skies over our adversaries are getting tighter and far more lethal. If a nation state can now routinely shoot down advanced, trusted airframes like an F-15, how does that change the calculus for the Pentagon? Are we rapidly approaching a tipping point where sending human beings into these heavily defended, hyper-lethal environments simply becomes an unsustainable risk?
Wait, you're saying the cost of a combat search and rescue mission might eventually outweigh the tactical benefit of having a pilot in the cockpit to begin with?
Precisely. If the rescue package requires an armada that is just as vulnerable to the air defenses as the downed pilot was, commanders will eventually stop sending the armada. It forces us to ask if we are looking at a near future where only unmanned systems, autonomous drones, and AI-driven platforms fight in the contested airspace of our adversaries. The risk of a downed human pilot and the ensuing geopolitical crisis of rescuing them might simply be too catastrophic to bear.
A future where the ticking clock in the dark mountain crevice doesn't belong to a human being at all, but just a piece of metal waiting to be remotely wiped. That is a chilling strategic shift, and definitely something to keep in mind the next time you see a polished military briefing on the news. Thank you for joining us on this deep dive. Keep questioning the headlines, keep looking for the messy reality behind the spin, and we will catch you next time.